A Woman, a Lake Spirit, and a Skull, Part 2, 34 Minutes.
But the trickster story seems to be a little bit divergent.
Well, I put that in, and also the Polynesian stories, because there's stories about a penis in a lake. You know, because in the trickster story, the penis goes underneath the water of the lake and comes out the other side. And in the eel story, the eel is like a penis, and it's in the bottom of the ocean or in a pool.
The thing that immediately struck me about these stories was that usually there's a reverse connection with the penis. Something is talked about, but we interpret it and say, well, they're really talking about a penis. But here it's just the opposite. They're talking about a penis that's referring to something else. Very intriguing.
Well, you know, the fairy stories that we have, all of Grimm's fairy stories have been bowdlerized, which means all the sexy parts were cut out, you know, because it wasn't proper, they weren't respectable, and they were recorded by respectable 18th century gentlemen. So most of the, and that's true also for French and English and Italian fairy stories, they've almost all been prettied up. So even though they still contain some gruesome parts, mostly the sex has been taken out. And really, these fairy stories tended to be pretty raunchy because, you know, they were told by peasants, you know, around the kitchen at night. It was not polite society. So, and they were for adults. They weren't for children only. They were for all ages. And, you know, sex is everybody's of interest, so there was a lot more sex in there than we would see. So the thing is, if you can find fairy stories like these that haven't been censored, then you get a better, more realistic sense of what fairy stories can be like. You know, these are ones that escaped because of the way they were recorded. And there's an exception to what I'm saying, and that is the story of Tatterhood, which is a European fairy story, but the sex is disguised. So it's very much about sex, but it's all disguised. So the censors never got to it because they didn't recognize it.
The story of Tatterhood is on my website with an analysis, so you can find it there if you want to look at it.
But anyway, this is an example of a more bawdy Polynesian, Eskimo, Melanesian. They're much more. It's not just body, it's visceral, much more visceral, much more about the body, the human body.
Were these both from Franz Boas?
I think so. But yes, it has symbolic meaning, of course. What do you think? Does anybody want to try and interpret the whole thing? Let's start from the beginning. Anybody want to hazard a guess?
I mean, to me, it seems like. Well, Joseph Campbell was a student of Jung, right?
I guess.
Yeah, so what was his thing in the Voyage of the Hero? What was
the Hero Journey?
The Journey of the Hero. Yeah, it seems that way to me. I mean, these girls, this girl isn't content to follow in the parental image of the path of life. She does it in her own true, it's a hero for voyage for her. She's finding individuation, the interception of the anima and animus, the feminine and masculine, the yin and yang, through her own individual journey using instinct and nature as her guide, not the habitual generational mores and culture that say a good girl must do this. So it's like a hero's journey.
I think you're right, absolutely right. I mean, it's a heroine's journey. But yes, I think so. And one of the reasons that I thought it was so interesting is, and I have some others too, because it's entirely a feminine. It's the journey of the feminine, and it's very different from a hero's journey, but it's the same. The same kind of thing, but how it looks.
But how How does it? No, I mean, I understand it's a woman looking for a penis as compared to a man looking for something else. But wouldn't a man sort of do the same sort of things with the just different Holy Grail than the penis? But the steps of disavowing the parents and killing the parents symbolically and following his own path, seems like the hero, it's the same journey.
It's similar. It's parallel, but it's not the same.
What's the difference?
Well, as we go through it, there's a lot of details. You have to excuse me for a minute, because...
Well, you know, the old one. Cigar is only a cigar.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Yeah, someone told me, you know, I have this young analyst, and he told me something very interesting. You know, we're talking about the setting sun, the fact that I'm getting older. And he said Freud basically was, you know, for the first half of life, you know, and Freud used to never took a patient over 45 who was all about the individuation, the hero's journey. And Jung was really more about the second half of life and the wisdom and that stuff. So that was kind of interesting. I never had heard that before.
So that Freud was more interested in the first part?
Yeah, the first part.
Like, the sex was more important.
Of course.
You get a little older, you go, you know, it's good, but all this other stuff,
too. And Jung is more focused on the individuation piece.
But focused on the spiritual.
Yes, more in the spiritual second half. You know, what lessons have you learned? Because I have a nephew that I kind of watch out for a little bit. And I said, you know, bringing him, he's like 19 years old, to a young therapist would probably be a mistake. And he kind of agreed with that. Because it's, you know, this fire that you need when you're young isn't as important after 45 or 50 or whatever it is, I guess.
Yeah, you haven't read Zorba the Greek, obviously.
No.
We have been recorded, so you can...
I just said my therapist who's young and said that Freud was really for the first half of life, and if over 45 he didn't really want to take patients, and about going out there in the hero's journey, and Jung was more in the second half of the wisdom
I think it is a heroine's journey. I just think the differences are very interesting because it's not the same. It's similar. The differences, I think, and it's also interesting because there's so much emphasis in mythology on the masculine. You know, so many times it's masculine. It's told through a masculine lens. So we look at it through a feminine lens, and we discover some unexpected things. So that's
none of them got pregnant. So they obviously had contraceptives or something. Unlike our current culture, where we're going no sex without babies. Yeah.
Yeah.
All these penises. I didn't hear any babies in the whole thing. No, no babies. Calvaries. I heard calvaries, but no babies.
Okay. So now, well, what about, let's start from the beginning. What about the idea of a penis in a lake? And I put an illustration there of King Arthur receiving the sword from the lake. You know, it's a phallic instrument. The lady in the lake gave him the sword, so... the penis coming out of a lake. In the lake represents, or the ocean represents, the unconscious, mm-hmm. and it's a maternal kind of symbol. You know, the unconscious we think of as the great mother is the unconscious. So, again, if the lake comes out, if the penis comes out of the lake, it's like the penis is coming out of the great mother. So, what could that mean psychologically? The reason I gave you those amplifications is because they repeat that idea.
It's like my moon's in Capricorn, which just means within my unconscious there's a certain need, ambition, or whatever. So it seems like within the lake, there's a treasure, and it's different. My treasure is different than yours. Different. Everybody's is different. But what? The hero's journey is to uncover within the unconscious what's uniquely yours.
Yes.
What's on your path?
Okay, so yes, and let's continue. What about, say more, let's think about this a bit more. See, I mean, a penis is very much phallic. It's very much a phallic masculine, associated more with the masculine. But the image is very clear in many different cultures. It actually comes from the Greek myth.
Well, without women, no penises would exist. It's literally the feminine creates the sex, both sexes, or, you know, the mammals, the feminine creates it, as opposed to an egg hatching. So there's a, penises are created by the feminine.
In the sense that everything's created from an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and everything's born out of a womb. So that's biologically, right?
Mm-hmm.
What about psychologically? I mean, what more can we think about this? I'm not after anything specific,
no,
it's just
well,
a very
I think,
profound
you know,
idea.
Psychologically, when, you know, when you're a little kid recognizing you don't have it and explaining the concept of a friend who's going through it now with her daughter, she's kind of like, well, your parts are inside. She's like, get the inside business. You know, they're in there. And she's like, well, I want that. She's, you know, it's very, you know, it's kind of interesting because we were talking. She said, "What do I say?" I said, "Inside's kind of a hard concept." You know, how do you explain inside? You know, and an awareness. You know, kids notice differences, so there's an awareness of the difference. So
I don't know how deep is this, but at least, I mean, in this story, when she goes to the lake, she calls for a penis, not for the man. So there's completely disassociated the figure of the man, of the rational from this, that's probably related to what you said, that it's more the mother nature providing, the rational, the unconscious providing, not the man, but the rational.
Well, I'm not yet, it's certainly not a real man, that's for sure. She's not after a whole man. But I'm not sure whether the penis might symbolize discrimination of all kinds, including rational. You know,
well, the recognition that that's what she wants. She wants that. She doesn't want, you know, other things. She's
right.
Calling for that specifically.
But let's think about what that is that she wants. What?
She wants sex.
Yeah, literally, she's seeking sex. But symbolically,
What do men do better than women? Well, supposedly, and I'm not a chauvinist, I don't think, but men, let's say, might have a better rational faculty versus an emotional-related faculty, discrimination. Now, I'm not saying that's true. There's a lot of differences. So maybe discrimination, rationality, the ability to fight, defend yourself, and you know, the things that a man traditionally, you know, the typical man has.
The myth actually enables us to step aside from the assigning this to the sex, because it's really, it's a penis. It's not a man or a woman. It's a penis, and the penis represents phallic energy. So as does a sword, and it represents the ability to penetrate and to move in one direction.
Discriminate.
And to discriminate. So it's phallic energy,
mm-hmm.
which is clearly belongs to the Great Mother. I think one thing that the image says points out is that the ability to discriminate and to penetrate is an archetypal potential in the unconscious, which can be claimed by whomever, but it's a potential in the unconscious. And when it's in the lake, it exists. When it's in the unconscious, it is only a potential. It's not actually, let's take that back. It can exist unconsciously. It can function and exist in the lake, under the water, unconsciously. The eel under the water, it's phallic potential, but it's underwater. Which is to say, both men and women unconsciously can be penetrating. You know, women as well as men can say sharp and penetrating things that, you know, cut you to the quick. You know, that's not the province of just men. Women can say nasty things and cut you to the quick. That's the phallic energy. And as for discrimination, when ideas come out of the unconscious, there are discriminations going on, like dreams make all kinds of discriminations, right? Dreams are not conscious unless we study them and analyze them. But they come out of the unconscious as complex stories which are making subtle distinctions, unconsciously. You know, that's another case of where it's not conscious rationality, but it's unconscious rationality.
And it seems that when people discuss dreams, we make further distinctions. I mean, that's what's interesting about dreams to me.
Well, we begin to examine them consciously.
Or if you ask someone about their dream, they start, oh no, it's not that, it's this. It's like, do you notice the process of discriminating within the dream? But it seems related to this.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, in other words, when you tell a dream and you talk about it, before you analyze it, you're already saying, no, it wasn't him, it was her, or he didn't climb the ladder,
right.
He tumbled down the ladder.
Right.
Those are distinctions.
Yes, which are sort of messages.
It's a message, absolutely. When the kite dropped the ox's tail, you know, there were all kinds of rational, unconscious communication. Something is happening, and you need to pay attention to it. It's this, it's not that.
If you take the penis for a masculine principle, there's a whole Greek astrological symbols of Mars and Mars and the sun, Aries, and the elements, air and fire, as compared to like Venus and the moon and earth and water. So if you look at it as a masculine thing, there are a lot of Western symbols that can be brought into it.
Right, but here's a place where you can avoid the sexist process by making that distinction. If you call it phallic rather than masculine, then that's available to everybody. If you call it masculine, it makes women feel that they don't have such access.
The student was relating phallic to masculine, which I think is correct. Those are very similar concepts. And I was at cross purposes here because I was thinking of the distinction between phallic and male, which is a different word altogether, male as opposed to masculine. I don't think I did justice to what the student was saying here.
But actually,
that's just being politically correct. Because,
that's in Jung itself.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction.
It's not about...
It's very important distinction. It's phallic.
Mm-hmm.
And men, it is true that men in our culture are more consciously or unconsciously conditioned to identify with phallic power on the average.
And biochemically, genetically.
No, I don't know about that. I don't know what the biochemistry says. Men have a penis, so because of their biology, they're more biologically triggered to identify with the phallic world.
Well, during gestation, there's a profound brain development difference with estrogen and testosterone, and supposedly, I'm not an expert, but I've read a lot on it, that the brain structure of a typical male is different than the brain structure of a typical female. I mean, anatomically,
the psychological process is not so sexist, and it seems like you're trying to take us away from that black and white definition to understand a process that is transcends those categories.
It's good all that I'm saying, but you can't necessarily throw away masculine too, because there is something to
that. Masculine exists, but if we talk about phallic, we can avoid the sexist stereotype. We don't have to do it.
Well, not necessarily in America, but
what's that?
Not necessarily in America, but you know, concept's good of avoiding the sexist. Phallic, we kind of tend to go as masculine. You know, it's just culturally a training.
But you see, when you look at it, that's why the myths are interesting.
That's why the myths are interesting,
because they point out.
Yes,
and a lot of them are translated more as phallus than penis. I have found. myths often talk about phallic things and have words, the languages have words that are more like phallus than penis, which is a, doesn't matter to me. I think it, when you said, when I heard it being read, I kept thinking, it sounds more phallic than penis to me. But that's just me. But I think a lot of other myths from other cultures talk about phallus as more of a phallic energy. It's not really about biology.
When we think of it as masculine, we get into tangles. As the, you know, whereas you think of the phallic, it's simple. You just, it's phallic.
So it's not really the hero's journey. It's the or a hero's. It's because heroine would be feminine, right?
It would be more accurate to say it's the journey of the feminine.
Well, in her case, she was a young girl who didn't want to marry.
That's
as bad
to say masculine. Wait, hold it. We said masculine. That's not accurate because, you know, we're saying that for discrimination purposes. Let's not say masculine.
But we're getting tangled up in terminology.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying it's very unclear, this distinctions. I know what you're getting at, but it's not so easily. It's not so easily put.
Well, let me say it this way. Okay, more precisely. You're helping me to be precise, so I appreciate it. How about, let's say, it's the journey of the feminine principle, which is an unconscious principle that is present in both sexes, but which women are more likely to identify with in the culture growing up.
Well, that was my whole point about saying masculine, which is, saying masculine is just as accurate as...
Well, let's say the masculine principle.
Masculine principle. Okay.
Which is not men, the masculine principle, which belongs to both sexes.
Mm-hmm. Both sexes are masculine.
I'm no longer startled. Because I've gotten over this, but I remember when I first started hearing young women talking with one another, they would talk about you guys. You guys, let's do this, or you guys. And it startled me at first, because they're not guys, they're gals. But they're no more gals. Everyone's a guy now. Let's go, you guys.
Okay. But also, this girl is refusing to be married. And her parents are really pissed off with her. Well, you said she's refusing to go along with the convention.
Societal convention, parental convention.
Why? Why do you think she's doing that? What do you make of that?
She's awake.
She's what?
Awake.
She's awake.
Or she's a rebel.
Okay. What else can we say about it? I mean, I agree with you. I think it's... It's profound.
Yeah, she's looking for her own destiny. She is exploring her unconsciousness to find the answer.
Dirac had the same issue.
Well, she's ritualistic in it too, because at the same time every evening she would sing outside the tent, "From the lake, O penis, come out." So she's talking to the feminine, asking for the phallic to emerge. So she doesn't want to get married. She quarrels with us. But who is she married to? She's married to whatever Kele is in the lake. The penis of the lake?
Spirit. I think it's an evil spirit is the way they understand it. Or a spirit, a mischief-making spirit, I think.
And then she calls again one more time. And... a mirror penis appeared, which mirrors in parentheses, and she copulated with it. Again, not a physical presence, but a penis.
Right.
So, and clearly knew the part of the body. She sat down upon it and copulated, so she knew what to do with it, even if she wasn't getting married. No, because, I mean, it could be, you could do a lot of things with it.
Right.
What else could happen?
I'm not going there.
You say yourself.
But there are other things you do.
Please tell us more.
It's a mere penis. What are we going to do with it?
Well, we could say that the natural course of the normal biological course of events has been somehow interrupted or shifted in some way, you know, marriage. I don't know whether that's fair to say that's the normal biological course of events or that's the normal social course of events has been somehow displaced. When does this happen to people? I mean, if you think of it in terms of people's lives, how would you see this? How would you understand this situation of not electing to marry the football player in your class?
In this society, it's probably at an early age. You know, I imagine that this lady probably should be around 16, something like that, or probably earlier, I mean, younger.
So it might be a younger stage?
Yeah.
Okay.
I understand in this society, probably in our society, it's not necessarily, we expect that people get married at 16 or 15.
It's probably more prevalent in the 60s than it is today, perhaps. In the 60s, it seems like, you know, what was the word, anti-disestablishmentarianism, or whatever it is, and go, you know, because, you know, they came from the 50s, and there was this, I was born right after, so I wasn't really a flower child in the 60s, but it seems like there was a very much countercultural revolution, conscious breaking. Where New York, it's the hero's journey seems much tougher because, you know, getting money and the trophy wife and all that kind of stuff seems to be what is much easier to buy into. Nice place on the east side or, you know, whatever it is. Nice job and 401k, and, right? Especially for Jewish.
Okay.
Especially for the Jewish culture.
Maybe another way to say it is that there's some kind of dislocation. Probably in some, you know, if the conventional pattern works for you, why not go with it? You know, you get the husband, you get the children, you get the house, you get the, you know, if the conventional pattern works, it's going to be the easiest way. It would seem to be the easiest way to proceed if you can follow in the collective. So there's some kind of dislocation.
Mm-hmm.
In the collective pattern, for whatever reason. You know, it might be because the woman was gay, it might be because she was very, very intelligent and all the men that were available to her looked like dummies to her, so she couldn't be satisfied, you know. She might have a compulsion to be a poet, and she doesn't want to get pregnant because she wants to write poetry. Something dislocates the traditional collective thought.
It's very subtle because it's, I think, the common denominator is being awake. And in an awakened state, you can follow the traditional path, or you can become, drop out and become a mountain climber, following your own individual path. So, you know, who can say, you know, if you casually know someone, you couldn't know if they were on a hero's journey, because it could look just like everybody else, but that's in sync with their inherent values and the path they should follow.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they're doing it consciously,
mm-hmm.
as compared to unconsciously, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the external trappings sometimes aren't indicative.
It's kind of like Gloria Steinem. In
what way?
Well, just breaking with convention, and she's got a male partner, but yet, you know, writes for women, etc., and male dominance.
It was very interesting. Franz Boas, he was a German Jew who came to the United States, and he was a professor of anthropology at Columbia. He took a trip to the Northwest, where I guess he got these stories. And from my dim memory of anthropology 101. I remember that he visited a tribe called the Kwakiutl of the Pacific Northwest. I assume that's where these stories came from, but there were movies that he took very early on, early 19th century. And in my memory, you see these natives covered with fur skins, and they're dancing around poles, and they're doing things with tomahawks, and it's all very, very primitive. And suddenly out of this culture comes this beautiful story of women's lib. It's fascinating.
Actually, it's Siberian, but he did so many expeditions, this is a Siberian. And then I made a point that the Garden of Eden is another parallel. There is the serpent.
It would seem the reverse, because they were cast from unity, they were cast into ignorance. So it seems like it's actually the counter opposite of the path of individuation of wisdom. It's that they went into darkness, right?
Well, actually, you know, that was they went into consciousness. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were unconscious. They didn't know they were naked. Once they were cast out, they knew they were naked and they were ashamed. See, it was the beginning of consciousness.
But also prejudice. You know, this whole idea of unity and recognizing the individual. I think, well, their troubles began there.
Yeah, well, so consciousness is the source of all troubles, if you like.
Yeah, but it seems like a lower level consciousness,
well,
as compared to...
It's the beginning of all troubles, and then...
It is.
And then you spend thousands of years working on it, and maybe you get a little better, but actually not, because look what's going on in Afghanistan. We're way back there. No, consciousness is a troublemaker. It's not, doesn't make things... The harmony, the original harmony was in the garden. When they were unconscious, they were harmoniously integrated with nature.
They were just happy.
Just happy.
Just happy.
Didn't know anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then ate an apple.
Yeah, see, they ate the tree of knowledge.
Spring vegetables get you every time. Not a good thing.
Go there.
The consciousness is what makes us the difference between us and the animals.
And the animals don't have wars, and they don't have the same kind of...
They have their own trouble, but not ours, clearly.
And they live in harmony with nature, whereas we don't.
Well, can I bring in a little physics?
Well, no, I think animals are vicious.
Yes, briefly.
Quantum mechanics? Anybody?
What?
Quantum mechanics? Anybody?
It depends.
Maybe it's
yeah.
Like a...
You're an engineer. Quantum mechanics.
Well, oh, that says it all. Thank you.
The notion is that consciousness is the most powerful force in the universe. Because it's consciousness. It's our consciousness which brings things into existence. Without consciousness, everything in the universe exists in what the quantum mechanics call superposition. One thing and another thing can occupy the same space, the same time, but it's consciousness which finally, as the quantum mechanics say, collapses the wave equation. Makes things real. So for the
wait, what?
Makes things real. So for the greatest, the quantum mechanics, the founders, Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg, it's called the strong interpretation. Consciousness is actually the most powerful thing. It's what brings things into, makes things tangible.
Well, let's stop with that, because that's interesting, but I don't think we can pursue it here.
Okay.
Thank you. But it's interesting. It's relevant.
Yeah, I thought of that because of this thing about consciousness.
Sure.
What a mixed bag it is for us.
This is the end of part 2. The discussion continues in part 3.